This is our reading group continuing our reading Neo-Finalism. We're in chapter 12, and we are picking up from page 126 of the translation. So I think last time we finished chapter 11, like the last couple pages, and then started into chapter 12. So yeah, we're still going through this idea of, one of his sort of key concepts that he's developing in this book is this idea of the transspatial realm. So this is the realm of meanings or values. And throughout this book, up till now, he's been sort of giving his presenting various arguments for why we need to sort of accept that there is such a thing as this transspatial realm, in addition to the realm of spatial temporal physical events. And so a lot of his arguments have had to do with embryology or development of living beings. But then he's also used a sort of like embryo brain analogy that, can you hear me? I think I just lost my connection for a second. Okay, good. Yeah. So he's been developing this sort of embryo brain analogy. And so the idea is that the process through which an organism, an already formed organism with a brain learns, new behavior, new skills, et cetera, is analogous in some sense to the process through which the embryo develops into an organism with differentiated tissues and organs and so on. And so in each case, there's a sort of finalism and equipotentiality in a sense. So in the case of the embryo, there's all these experiments that he's talked about here where you take a sea urchin embryo and slice it in half and swap the two sides, and it develops into a sort of normal looking sea urchin rather than like having some sort of gruesome, disassembled parts or whatever. And so the part that would have developed into the left side after this, bizarre intervention develops into the right side. So it has the sort of potential to develop differently than it does in the normal course of development. And of course, this is not the only sort of intervention that it's capable of responding to and adapting to. So likewise, in the brain of the organism, these organisms evolve in in a certain type of environment, and they're sort of ready to respond to certain features of that environment. But if for whatever reason they happen to develop in a completely different environment, then they're still obviously not infinite or completely absolutely flexible capacities, but there's still some capacity to adapt to a different environment and learn things that in the sort of developmental the evolutionary history of this organism would never have been encountered before. You can think of some animal gets swept out to sea and ends up on an island and has to adapt to a completely different set of prey and predators and habitats and so on that organism has never experienced in its evolutionary history before. This is something, again, it's not in the sort of infinite adaptability. A rainforest animal might not be able to adapt to a desert environment or vice versa. But there is a certain amount of flexibility that, they can learn to do things differently or learn new skills that they didn't have before, et cetera. This is sort of like the basis of his analogy between the embryogenesis and learning. And in each case, there's a sort of directedness towards an end or a goal or a value that it sort of guides this transformation through time. And so this realm of like the values or the goals that are that these processes are directed towards, that's what he's sort of exploring in this or in the last couple chapters. I'm just gonna see if there's anything else in this last couple pages that we need to pick up. So maybe one last point is that he sort of emphasizes on the one hand that the development of an embryo is a kind of invention or creativity in the sense that each instance of that development is creatively working towards the achievement of those ends or those goals in development. And so there's nothing sort of like preset that determines, the tadpole embryo to just in case some experimenter swaps your left and right legs, here's what you should do. There's no like sort of pre-existing instructions for how the tadpole embryo is supposed to respond in this situation. It has to sort of like, you know, figure out in a sense. I mean, it's kind of a extended sense of what we would mean by like figuring out, but it has to sort of figure out what to do in this bizarre situation that has not been sort of accounted for already. It has to, you know, adapt to this circumstance and, you know, try to produce a normal tadpole at the end of this developmental process. But then at the same time, this creativity is not sort of like completely open-ended and just sort of arbitrary, because of course, a frog egg will normally develop into a tadpole. It will not develop into an oak tree or a chicken. We can be, I think, pretty confident of that assertion. And then likewise, an acorn will not develop into a frog and so on. So the frog egg has a sort of, inventive capacity or creativity in terms of, responding to these different environmental interventions, that make, the egg gets divided in half during development, earlier than it's supposed to or something like that. And then it will just develop into two tadpoles instead of one. So it has this sort of capacity to respond creatively to unforeseen circumstances. But it also is sort of, that creativity is kind of bounded in the sense that it's always sort of directed towards tadpole development rather than, oak tree or chicken. And then also another sort of limitation or like a sense in which this creativity is limited is of course that even within the realm of, developing towards a tadpole, there's not a sort of infinite capacity to adapt to unforeseen circumstances. And so I think I mentioned last time, like if the intervention is like dousing this frog egg in cyanide, the egg is probably not going to be capable of adapting, no matter how sort of creative it is, it's not going to be able to adapt to this circumstance and produce a viable tadpole. So there's a sort of boundedness in the sense that it's always going to be directed towards producing a tadpole, and then also a sort of limitation to the extent to which it can exercise that creativity and invention in the face of, more extreme, I guess, circumstances. So creativity, but not sort of infinite and arbitrary creativity is sort of what he's getting at here. Okay, so we can pick up from page 126 at the list item B, mnemic subsistence.
I can read. B, mnemic subsistence. Experimental psychology has demonstrated that in the vast majority of cases, humans only recall meaning. When it bears on meaningless syllables or figures, the effort of memorization essentially consists in relying on auxiliary meanings or on various quote-unquote expressivities, rhythms, spatial clusters. Expressivity here being here as everywhere else, a quote non-explicit meaning, unquote. When memorization progresses, auxiliary meanings and mnemotechnical quote-unquote tricks are often abandoned, but the active memorization of a meaningless material cannot do without the detour through a quote-unquote signification or a quote-unquote expressivity. And the same holds for the quote-unquote memory that passes through notional quote-unquote detours. For instance, a subject who has to memorize a pair of syllables, the pair of syllables vis, hus, relies on the analogy with vicious, then abandons the auxiliary term when the pair becomes familiar to him. It is very doubtful that a mechanical or photographic memory, an absolutely pure memory, pure of every meaning or expressivity, could exist. Naturally, experimental psychology cannot resolve the problem of the mode of mnemic subsistence on its own. But even if memorization and recollection rely on quote-unquote meanings, one cannot easily claim to relate the mnemic subsistence between memorization and recollection to a phenomenon of mechanical inertia, especially when so many other facts, especially those analyzed by the Würzburg school, Freud, Bourlaud, Ellenberger, in Dreams and Spontaneous Associations, uncover the peculiar life of mnemic spheres almost directly, and when the analogy between invention and memory corroborates the presence of the transspatial. this subsistence has to be of the same order as the subsistence of non-mnemic meanings, that is, of essences. In their phenomenological status, essences are eternal. They are endowed with ubiquity. An inventor can invent and perfect his invention in any part of the world. In the region of essences, the similars are identified, while in the region of existence, similar beings can be numerically different. The status of mnemic individual or specific subsistence is quite similar. Psychological individual memory possesses a kind of ubiquity. I can evoke my recollection as well in Asia or America as in Europe, a kind of eternity. A recollection is detached from time. It can return to me at any moment. It is, quote-unquote, eternal up to my death. Last, it escapes number in the sense that the same memory can be actualized any number of times, mutating slightly at each moment. Organic memory is even closer to essences. Its ubiquity is less relative than that of individual memory. Multiple embryos of the same species can develop simultaneously, very far from one another. Its eternity is also less relative. A specific memory can endure for millions of years, altering somewhat at each ontogenesis, so long as a single couple of the species survives. Despite everything, however, a difference always subsists between specific memory and the authentic eternity of the essence. Quote-unquote red could reappear even if, at a given moment, no quote-unquote red existed in the universe, and if, quote, the species of reds, unquote, so to speak, were temporarily extinguished. The specific memory of a vanished species is annihilated forever. Where is the specific memory of dinosaurs? Finally, a specific memory eludes number in the sense that it can pertain to any number of individuals, while being universal and indivisible like the essence. Yeah, I thought this point about kind of semantic memory was interesting, something I was thinking about recently.
Sorry, just a second. There's like one paragraph left of this section. Do you want to just read the last paragraph?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Sorry, thanks.
Oh, no problem. We can thus glimpse the profound reason for the effort towards sense that every memorization makes. The actual can only escape time by participating as much as possible in the status of the essence, by profiting in some sense from its eternity to gain a precarious and limited immortality. An idea, a memory, is a hybrid between the eternal and the actual. If I have an idea at some point, this idea that is mine and ephemeral like me will also be universal, like the essence it aims for, and in principle, eternal in the same way. A memory is always necessarily an idea. Bergson's assertion that every actual automatically becomes a memory is false. The actual becomes a memory only when it is imbued with quote-unquote sense, which renders it incorruptible. Our recollections subsist only when they are transmitted in time through the eternity of essences. So the point about, semantic memory or memory being memory of sense or what something means, often, you know, if I go out to a restaurant or something with my girlfriend, and we talk about, she brings something up from that night, you know, weeks later, and it takes a little while to kind of like triangulate which restaurant, she's talking about or I'm talking about if I bring it up, because, you know, we tend to remember, unless obviously just like know the name, but if it's someplace you've only been to once, we tend to remember different aspects of the place. And you know, it can take some time to kind of, figure out what the other person is talking about. And that may be because, you know, different, aspects of the actual experience in the present were salient to us. And so, you know, in a sense, it's, even though you're in the same place, it's, a different kind of, semantic recording that happens. The point about auxiliary meanings is very true in my experience trying to learn Japanese, especially kanji, which pretty much are, you know, meaningless marks to me until I know the radical or the radicals that are that compose a given kanji. And when you learn radicals, which are like the root figures of a bunch of different kanji, you do have to learn them as like, you know, having some kind of meaning. You know, there'll be a radical for like flower, and a radical for, I'm trying to think of an example, a radical for like pool. And, you know, when you encounter a new kanji, it first only makes sense to you as a combination of like flower and pool, for instance. And then once you've reviewed it a number of times, it has its own meaning and you don't need to really run through the radicals again. But it's a necessary step to getting to that point. And the point about the identity of essence and multiplicity of its instantiations is it's cool because I'm currently reading the the One and the Many Dialectic in Science of Logic. It's the same structure, I guess, that Rouillet is talking about here, that the different instances of the essence, you know, insofar as they're instances of the essence, aren't numerically distinct in an essential sense.
Yeah, there's the one and the many ones, and then the repulsion, and yeah, there's a bit of a kind of head cracking chapter from the Science of Logic, as far as I remember. I think there's a lot in this section that is interesting to go over. I think what you were talking about like sort of, you know, trying to remember which restaurant, or trying to like triangulate your memory with someone else of like what restaurant you were at on a certain evening. It sort of reminds me of in the beginning of Proust, where he's talking about like lying in bed and sort of like how it takes a while to sort of re-become the person that he was the day before. He has to sort of like, collect his sort of memories that make up who he is in the morning. There's a kind of like memory here is not just the sort of mechanical reproduction of something in the same way, in the way that an electronic, like a digital camera, of course, is sort of like recording the intensity of light on a surface in this, well, it's not mechanical, but it's electronic means that just sort of like has this very straightforward correspondence, and you know, the you just sort of like record that the intensity of light on this pixel at this time was n, and then when you replay the video, it just produces a sort of display where the corresponding pixel on your screen is n, when you replay it. And you know, human memory or memory of other animals, etc., you know, doesn't work anything like that. There's been like studies on like eyewitness testimony, like for like courtroom settings and so on. And it's actually, I think, a little bit terrifying about how much creativity is involved in like recollection of an event. It's nothing like this sort of automatic reproduction or like, you know, replaying something in like a recording on a camera. When you're observing the event, you are sort of interpreting what is happening. You understand, you know, what this person is doing, or how this other person is responding, etc. And then when you sort of recall what happened and, you know, give your account of it, you are sort of drawing on your understanding of what you observed at that time to sort of reproduce your recollection, which of course means that whatever sort of filter you put on the event, whatever interpretation you put on the event at the time, is what's going to be reproduced. And, you know, it's always possible that you're, you know, misunderstanding the event as you're observing it. And then you will sort of recall what you, you know, your interpretation, rather than a sort of direct description of just, you know, the actual facts that you were witness to. So it does, like, when you sort of like dig into how reliable eyewitness testimony is, it's a lot scarier than you might think. Elizabeth Loftus, I don't think I know who that is.
Sorry, she did a lot of the foundational into especially like courtroom testimony, and just how easily manipulatable memory is. I recall the name, but I know she did a lot of this.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll have to look into that. Yeah, like, and of course, I mean, in some cases, there's like sort of, I guess, deliberate manipulation of witnesses. Like, you know, police will sort of set up a lineup of suspects in such a way that they're, you know, they're sort of directing the witness to pick out a certain person that they, you know, the police, you know, quote unquote, know is the right person. And you know, in some cases that has turned out to, you know, not be the right person. But also even aside from sort of like deliberate manipulation, just sort of the you know, circumstances in which you're asked to recall something can affect the way that you recall that event. So it's just a sort of exemplification of the fact that recalling a memory is not a sort of mechanical reproduction of a trace in the way that replaying a video that you've recorded on a camera is, or not mechanical in the strict sense here, but a sort of broader sense of mechanical. Another element I think is interesting in this passage is when he talks about sort of memorizing or keeping in your memory something that is sort of meaningless for you. So you can think of like, no one really memorizes phone numbers anymore, of course, because we have, computers in our pockets that can store them. But in the few circumstances where you do have to remember a phone number, it's not that easy to do because, the sequence of numbers is essentially arbitrary. There's no sort of intrinsic meaning to, why this digit should be a six instead of a seven. And so you just basically have to, like, if you are going to memorize a phone number, you basically just have to, like, repeat it over and over to yourself until the sort of, I don't know, it almost becomes a sort of melody or something in your head where you just sort of, like, you've heard it so many times that once you say six, you just immediately think of three as the next number. And he also mentions here that, like, how when you do try to memorize this kind of, arbitrary information, one of the sort of tricks that sort of people land on, just by chance or just by, trial and error is like sort of either, well, one of the tricks is sort of assigning a meaning. So you can think of like these like mnemonics that students come up with when they have to memorize like there's one, I think, in biology for like the sequence of, species, genus. I can't even remember what all the other, like, there's like species, genus, and then above that, I think it's class, family. Anyway, there's like phylum. Anyway, there's a whole like series of different, degrees of categories of biological organisms. And then there's like a mnemonic that biology students, come up with that sort of gives the right order, like which, is an order, a higher category than a class or lower. You just like come up with a phrase that has the same first letters as the order, as the sequence of categories. There was one that I learned for the order of the planets when I was a kid, but then of course they demoted Pluto to not a planet anymore. So I guess they probably had to come up with a new mnemonic. So this is one sort of trick that many people around the world have come up with of like take some meaningless sequence of words or numbers or whatever, and then develop a somewhat meaningful, like at least a sentence, I guess, expression that sort of corresponds to that meaningless sequence in some way and allows you to sort of recall that meaningless sequence. Another one that he mentions here is rhythm. And I remember at one point, like, so there's this famous psychology paper from, I think, the 1950s. 1950s. It's called the magical number 7 ± 2. And the idea of this paper is that like your sort of working memory capacity, like short-term memory, is like seven sort of arbitrary elements. And then there's, plus or minus two, it sort of varies depending on what the specific task is. Like if you're remembering numbers or I don't know, shapes or whatever. So the idea is that like you can sort of hold in your working memory seven elements of whatever, type of entity you're dealing with, so it could be numbers or letters or whatever. If you go sort of beyond that, or too much beyond that range, then you can't really sort of, like, if you were asked to remember a sequence of 50 arbitrary letters, of course that really would not be feasible. You'd have to sort of, it takes some sort of very elaborate training system to sort of make yourself memorize that sequence. And something I remember, from years ago is that at one point I was able to like memorize my credit card number, which of course is 16 digits. But the way I did it was sort of like the rhythm of typing it out on a keyboard, as opposed to like actually, the numbers. Certain digits are repeated, so I sort of like was able to memorize that rhythm of the number, as if I were to sort of recite it from memory, I probably wouldn't be able to do it. But by typing it on the keyboard, I was able to, you know, reproduce it through that rhythm. And so here, like, the rhythm here is already a sort of pseudo meaning, I guess. It's not a sort of purely arbitrary sequence of numbers anymore. It's now something that has a kind of structure to it, like a sort of approach towards something musical in that sense. Like, rhythm is you know, one of the fundamental components of music. And this is, I guess, similar in a way to that the first sort of strategy that I was talking about, this sort of producing a mnemonic to sort of allow you to memorize this arbitrary sequence. So in each of these cases, you're taking something, you know, arbitrary, and then you're producing some sort of like non-arbitrary structure that allows you to reproduce that arbitrary sequence. So yeah, I think that's like a sort of general like rule, I guess, of like, you know, our capacity to just sort of memorize, like brute force memorize an arbitrary sequence is very limited. And this is, you know, sort of connected to what I was saying earlier about the, you know, sort of creativity of recall and the sort of unreliability in certain situations. Like, we're not really capable of just sort of recording the arbitrary sort of visual impressions or, you know, sensory impressions that a scene produces in us. And then just sort of recalling these arbitrary impressions. We are instead, like, the only way we can sort of recall what happened is by, like, assigning some sort of pattern or structure or meaning to those events. And then it's that sort of pattern that then gets sort of reproduced or re-actualized when we try to recall what happened. And, you know, of course, in everyday life, that's, you know, perfectly adequate and probably more useful than sort of recalling the, you know, every single visual detail of a scene. But then when it comes to like this sort of very high stakes situation of a trial, like a criminal trial, and sort of recalling the actual, you know, sequence of events, did this person, you know, do this at this time or whatever, that's when it becomes sort of dangerous. But yeah, and so I think in general, like a big part of this, the point of this section is that like memory is itself analogous to, you know, invention and the development of the embryo and all those other sort of processes that we've been going through in the rest of this book. Of course, you know, memory is supposed to be more constrained than invention. Like the whole point of inventing, you know, a new device or, you know, a new, you know, writing a poem or whatever is something, is supposed to be something that doesn't exist or hasn't existed before. Whereas in the case of memory, the idea is that you're supposed to be, you know, recalling what happened or recalling a fact or whatever. But in both cases, like it's just sort of a difference in like degree or a difference of like ratio of invention or, you know, new creation to reproduction, I guess, it is just sort of a different balance of those element or those factors in when you compare, you know, memory versus invention.
Yeah. Just a quick little aside. You mentioned the effect of iPhones on memorization of phone numbers, but I feel like a more pernicious effect is the effect it has on our ability to navigate like a new area, which I feel like, you know, before iPhones, you could go to a new area, you would find your way to somewhere once, maybe twice, but you would also have a general layout of the entire area, so you might be able to take different routes or at least you know, take a wild guess at a different route and still get to where you're going. And now you're absolutely reliable on Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever. But another aspect of this little section that appealed to me was, you know, Rouillet can be pretty dry at times, very, very matter of fact, I guess, and he writes. But there is I feel there's a more sort of romantic side to him, and I really like how he talks about that the actual is necessarily sort of ephemeral, and that it strives to memory to touch immortality. He says no matter how delicate or whatever here, and I like that idea, you know, and then, you know, just us being actuals, like our body, similarly ephemeral, sustain continuity through access to this absolute domain of essences that he's laying out. And Just another little point in here I liked is that he suggests that the proximity to these essences in the absolute domain sort of parallels the different levels of consciousness or whatever conscious domains that he's laid out, and that's the embryo, for instance, has a more direct connection, or organic memory is even closer to essence. So I don't know. I kind of enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think you can sort of connect this with Spinoza talks about how sort of the form of immortality that a human being can sort of strive towards is sort of living in this sort of eternal sense that, like, insofar as our mind is sort of directed towards eternal truths, whether that's geometry, or more specifically the contemplation of God, to that extent we are immortal. And I think, like, even maybe less sort of specific to Spinoza, you can think of someone like Socrates, is sort of immortalized by Plato, right? Like this individual human organism that existed in 4th century BC Athens, has been dead for 2,000 years. But like the sort of set of thoughts and ideas that his life was directed towards is sort of like immortal because of the way that that has been sort of conveyed to us by Plato. And so, like, the sort of Socrates idea is this like entity that is now sort of has this kind of eternity independent of the biological organism, Socrates as an individual person, an individual human animal. So it's a kind of immortality through sort of actualizing, or how do I put this? A sort of immortality through living in this realm of essences. That sort of goes beyond the obviously limited spatial temporal existence of any individual person. Another element here that I meant to bring up and then forgot is when he talks about like a sort of contrast between like red as a sort of essence and then say like I don't know a certain dinosaur, T-Rex or whatever. Of course T-Rex is a kind of essence in the sense that there were many individuals that each sort of actualize this essence in a certain period of time, but of course we know that T-Rex is extinct, unless there's like the secret Antarctic jungle that where they survive and no one's ever discovered it yet, or maybe in the center of the Earth or whatever. So this essence was around was manifested or was actualized in a certain era of the Earth's history, and then at a certain point, the T-Rex went extinct, and there was no more capacity to sort of actualize that essence. It is just sort of like a dormant essence or something. And he talks about like the color red. You can sort of imagine that some catastrophic event appears, happens in the universe that destroys everything that happens to have, the color red. There's no red entities left in the universe. I mean, I don't know exactly how this would happen, but it's conceivable at least. Here, like this sort of essence of, redness is sort of the fact that it doesn't currently exist doesn't really prevent it from, reappearing at some future time in the way that, say, the T-Rex disappearing prevents, future T-Rex instances from appearing. And I'm thinking here also of there's the famous passage in Hume where he talks about how, we can only ever reproduce what we perceive. Like, we only have these ideas that are the sort of the faint copies of impressions. But then he says, what if you had like a palette of colors and there was one specific shade of blue that was missing from this palette? Would you be able to sort of like fill in that missing shade? And he says, yes, but that's not really important. Like, this is just sort of like a one little exception to this principle that we can only ever reproduce the impressions that we receive. But yeah, so here this like universe in which the color red is missing is kind of analogous to this like you know, color palette that's missing the this one shade of blue. I think here, like the difference between, say, like the Essence Red and then the Essence T-Rex is that Red is a much more simple essence than, you know, T-Rex. To sort of re-actualize this Essence Red after it has disappeared from the universe just requires, you know, well, I mean, color is actually a lot more complicated than maybe it looks, but anyway, it's a relatively simple essence to actualize. You just need, you know, surfaces that have a certain property of absorbing various wavelengths of light, etc. Whereas the Essence T-Rex, of course, is extremely complicated. You know, it would have been made up of many hundreds of different cell types that are organized into tissues and organs and are, you know, connected to each other in the appropriate ways and so on. Today there are these, like, there's that one biotech startup whose name I can't remember that is, like, claiming to, you know, de-extinct various animals, the dire wolf. They've said that they've succeeded with the dire wolf, and they're working on woolly mammoths and so on. But this is already, like, I mean, their claims are a little bit absurd, because they're not really, like, what they're doing is essentially, like, doing genetic engineering on existing organisms to make them sort of look like the extinct ones. That's basically all they're doing. But even here, like, you know, if you start from, let's say, an elephant as an existing organism, you know, an existing actualized essence of, you know, elephant, this is already, you know, quite close to, you know, in the sort of big picture of biology, quite close to the extinct mammoths. And even there, even then, when you're already starting from, like, you know, an elephant is already an extremely complicated entity with many, you know, different cell types and tissues and organs, you're just starting from that and like trying to tweak it a little bit to recover it, a very close, closely related, you know, type of organism, the woolly mammoth. Even then, it's not really something that we're really capable of doing. Like, we're not really sort of re-actualizing the now extinct woolly mammoth essence. We're just sort of, like, producing a new, you know, hairier elephant essence that sort of looks like a woolly mammoth. So you can think of, like even in this very, like, favorable case where we already have, like, whatever, 99%+ of the work done for us, we're still not really capable of getting that last 1%. Or whatever, you know, the last sort of bit of the difference that to sort of revive the woolly mammoth essence. And so this sort of gives an indication of, like, you know, when you sort of think of, like, recreating from scratch the essence of some extinct animal or plant or whatever, you know, why it should be essentially impossible to sort of recreate this essence once it's disappeared, as opposed to, you know, the Essence Red is this much more simple essence that, you know, even if you sort of imagine a universe in which every red entity had been destroyed, that, you know, the re-emergence of something that was red would not be that, you know, sort of hard to bring about or to, you know, foresee happening.
Yeah, the point that he makes in the last paragraph, I'm not sure I agree that his position is as opposed to Bergson as he's suggesting here. So, you know, the idea that memory, you know, has this semantic structure that kind of indicates that, you know, I mean, the present moment is probably individuated as meaningful. And if that's the case, then, you know, it always has some sense, even if it's not always a very clear one. And if that's true, then, you know, Bergson would be right to say that every actual becomes a memory because it has a meaningful structuration. Otherwise, it wouldn't be actual. But, yeah, I guess his point is just that if there were a you know, present experience that didn't have any meaning at all, it wouldn't become a memory and it wouldn't have this transspatial communication.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I was just gonna say, when I first read that, I got the same impression. I was like, it's not really a dig at Bergson. It's just, I guess, taking it, just maybe expanding Bergson's point a little bit, very, very slightly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm not sure exactly what he's getting at with Bergson here. Yeah, so I'd have to sort of go back to the Bergson texts, I mean, this is probably, I'm assuming, is a matter in memory that he's sort of referring to here. I'd have to go back to it and see, like, to what extent is his point here actually sort of, to what extent does it contradict what Bergson says? But I think, the idea here is that if you were to imagine some, completely arbitrary arrangement of entities, like, what is the L'Autriamont one, the coincidence of the umbrella and the sewing machine on a dissection table or whatever it is. You can imagine some sort of like absurd, list of entities that just happen to be sort of collected together. Insofar as this sort of collection of entities has no like structure or pattern or meaning or whatever, it would not become a memory, or it would not sort of be a memory. I think maybe what Bergson would say is that even this sort of like seemingly absurd, list of arbitrary entities, just by virtue of being collected together, like already has like a sort of minimal meaning of just sort of being together in that very loose sense. But I don't know. I'd have to go back to the Bergson text to see if there's like a real sort of divergence of positions between, what Rie is saying here and what Bergson says there.
Yeah, maybe just put this in the chat, but maybe he'd say that aggregates are also actual, but they don't have a semantic structure for themselves. But yeah, he doesn't go into that distinction here.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so, a pile of sand, for Rie would not be something that you could sort of remember in that sense. If you turn the sand into a castle or whatever, you can have a memory of that sand castle, but a pile of sand as such is not something that is an idea or something that you can remember. So the pile of sand doesn't remember itself in the way that a cell is a sort of biological memory of itself, because it is constantly taking in nutrients from the outside and excreting waste products and sort of producing itself, keeping itself in existence. And of course, a human being as a whole organism is doing the same thing. The pile of sand is just, it doesn't matter for any one pile of sand or for any one grain in that pile of sand whether it is still in the pile or has been has fallen out of the pile, or like what the pile doesn't do anything to sort of keep itself in existence. It just is. And so this, the pile of sand is this aggregate that is only externally, like, for there may be some reason why you, when you observe this pile of sand, like if you walk into your living room, there's a pile of sand on the floor, this is going to have meaning for you. You're going to be like pretty surprised, where did this pile of sand come from, and you're going to try to figure out who put it there and so on. So here the pile of sand has a meaning for you as the external observer, but for that pile of sand itself, there's no sort of meaning of being a pile of sand, as opposed to a cell has a sort of meaning for itself. It remembers its existence in that biological sense.
Yeah, and just real quick, I don't want to really go into this because I have a lot more to say on it, but a strict materialist approach here would say, well, this is all very obvious that, of course, an embryo, a cell, is closer to this realm of absolute domains because it's storing memory as DNA, just assigning all of this to the role of, that would be an unfair kind of materialist dismissal of all of.
Yeah, and like you said, we don't need to get into this in like a lot of detail, but of course, we've talked about before that DNA on its own doesn't actually do anything. That's sort of like the point of like why DNA is such a useful molecule in living beings, is precisely because it is sort of stable over time, that it doesn't sort of participate in all these chemical processes going on within the cell, and it's only in the presence of all the other cellular machinery that the cell is capable of using a certain stretch of DNA as a template to produce proteins that, then do all kinds of interesting and useful things in that cell. And even like there's sometimes talk of like DNA as like a self-replicating molecule, which is also not really true, because the DNA, if you just take a strand of DNA, stick it in a petri dish, it just sort of sits there and doesn't do anything. It's only inside a cell that has all the, you know, machinery required that it, you know, it's the cell that reproduces the DNA molecule, not the DNA molecule that reproduces itself. So yeah, the DNA molecule is like an important resource for the cell's capacity to, you know, remember itself in that sort of broader sense. But yeah, the idea there's this sort of tendency to try to like, I guess like bring all the, you know, interesting capacities of the cell, that the, you know, this sort of biological memory capacity of the cell, and say that, oh, it's just sort of a program in the DNA that has kind of replayed by the cell, in the way that, say, like a video recording can be replayed on your laptop, which of course is, you know, an oversimplification of, you know, what exactly DNA is doing in a cell.
Yeah. What you said can't be overstated. I mean, that's absolute. But should we move on?
Yeah, we can go on to the next one. Let's see. Yeah, if you can start from, if you could read the next bit on starting from page 128, the list item C. Yeah, maybe you can go on. Yeah, C, and you can read D up to where the italicized bit starts.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah, and also there's...
Oh, you muted yourself.
Yeah, okay, I'll start here. Also, real quick, he references figure 41 here. All right, D, the action of resemblance. For a long time, philosophers emphasized that the impossibility of understanding the action resembles a strict horizon of the pure action. How can a form or a being A evoke the form or being B that resembles? Because resemblance is a relation of psychological or order that presupposes, and because, by hypothesis, A alone is presented when it evokes B. Everything becomes clear when we see the action resembling the inverse of successive actualization of the same idea or the same, in this case, the same idea, numerically and analogically, engenders a multiplicity of similar actualization. In the case of the action of a resemblance in actual form, seen as corresponding idea or essence, evokes the other possible actualization of the same. It should be stressed that from the form seen by the retina, the form seen as an idea, there is no quote-unquote passage, despite the upward arrow of the schema. Here he references figure 41, I'll get to. Because to explain the passage, an action of resemblance has to be introduced, and this would obviously displace the problem without resolving it. Every perception is thematic and directly grasps the eidos in the structure. Within a schema, the quote-unquote detour through the transspatial and transnumerically inevitably looks like a progression, but the essence in itself and the essence incarnated in a form are in fact identical by virtue of the transnumerical nature of the. In the same way that mnemic subsistence is a participation in the eternity of the essence, the action of resemblance is participation of the actual the law of numerical identity of similar, which reigns in the transspatial imitation. Imitation also poses as an insoluble problem for quote-unquote actualists and mechanists. How can the fact that A hears B sing explain the fact that A hums, in his turn, the heard tune? How can the sight of his mother's smiling face provoke the smile of the child? The auditory or visual cortical zone is not traced on the motor zone. The key to the solution resides in the remarkable isomorphism between imitation and memory. 1. We only imitate what we understand. We only imitate meaning, just as we only memorize. Imitation amounts to surmounting the spatial diversity and distance, as well as the difference of individuality between the imitated and the imitator, just as memory amounts to surmounting the temporal diversity and distance between a primary and its recollection. Imitation, like memory, reveals a difference in height between the threshold of recollection and the threshold of recognition. Experiments, especially on animals, Kohler, and on children, André Rey, have shown that we only imitate what we nearly manage to invent. But a threshold difference, like the difference between the threshold of recognition and the threshold of recollection, allows us to identify the right solution to it just before managing to invent or, quote-unquote, name it. The imitation memory analogy thus, incidentally, reinforces invention analogy. 4. Memorization is a function not only of the signifying, but also of the important, valuable in general. The well-known effects of mnemic reinforcement of affectivity and moderate emotion, which are themselves due to the intimacy between affectivity and the sense of value, have their counterpart in the fact, stressed by Duprel, that we particularly imitate what we admire. Hence, the enormous psychological and social role of models. The admiring emotion is to imitation what emotion in general is live. We can add that imitation in familial or social education prolongs the action of heredity. A child imitates his parents. His psyche is modeled on their psyche, just as the organism of the child was formed by the same potential that already forms six. The almost indiscernible use of procedures, mnemic and imitative, in biological reproduction is a very striking confirmation of the analogy and imitation. I don't have my notes handy from this, and I can't recall immediately what I was thinking when I first read this. But just quickly going back to the figure 41, so it was in the section, the action of resemblance. So he's thinking about the action here, that between the retina form seen as an idea and what the retina receives physically, the signal, the information it receives signal is... there's no passage, despite the upward arrow. I'll have to come back to that. I think he's just separating kind of how time works through domains, kind of the sequential aspect and kind of the material realm of where the retina is receiving the physical signal versus. And then this idea of imitation here. Okay, there was one section here where he talks about invention, and I like that he's made this point before, but essentially that no one is really ever coming up with an idea sort of de novo or just out of the blue, out of nowhere, that it's always through access to this shared domain of memory in the absolute. That's someone who's better.
Yeah, we were just going over in the chat here that this diagram is not exactly perspicuous. I think the idea here is that when you're trying to understand, you know, the action of resemblance. So why is it that, you know, you sort of see an animal today and that makes you think of an animal you saw yesterday, you know, that is similar, that resembles that animal. And I think what he's trying to get at with this diagram is that it's not your sort of perception of this animal today that is sort of acting on your, you know, memory of your perception of that animal yesterday in some sort of like direct sense. It's actually that you, when you're perceiving the animal today, you're sort of grasping an essence. And that same essence was manifested in the animal that you saw yesterday. And it's because of this sort of shared essence between these two perceived animals that you can sort of that you can evoke the memory of that animal you saw yesterday that resembles the one you see today. Anyway, the diagram could use a bit more explanation than what he gives. It's very, you know, for anyone who's just, you know, listening to the recording and not looking at the diagram, you aren't missing much because it's like some lines and circles and stuff that are mostly not labeled, so it's hard to tell what exactly it's supposed to be expressing. Yeah, so I think this bit about imitation is interesting because I can't remember the details of the experimental design, but there was this one experiment that I've read about, like a psychology experiment, where it was basically testing like infants' ability to sort of recognize goal-directedness in the behavior of adults when they're, you know, through visual perception. And so like they would play a scene of play a video of a person walking into a room and turning on the lights. And so in one version of the scene, the person has their hands full, they're like holding, you know, a box or whatever, and they use their head to hit the light switch and turn on the lights. And then another version of the scene, the person walks into the room with empty hands, you know, no, they're not carrying a box or anything, and then also uses their head to turn on the light switch. And yeah, so I can't remember exactly what the design was, but what they determined was that the infants were able to, like in the case where the person has their hands full and uses their head to turn on the light switch, the infant sort of recognizes that using the head is sort of like a not an essential component of this light switch task. It's just, you know, the fact that the person's hands are full makes it the easiest way to perform this task. Whereas in the case where the person, you know, walks into the room with empty hands and uses their head, the infant sort of treats the, you know, using your head as like the sort of essential component of this light switch task, that like you can only turn on the lights by, you know, using your head. And so here, you know, like this infant is sort of like grasping some sort of structure of the situation that, like, you know, if the person is using their head when their hands are available, then there must be some reason for that. There must be some goal that can only be achieved by using your head to press the button or the switch or whatever. Yeah, here this very sort of like simple situation that is like, you know, a couple seconds visual scene is already sort of subject to an interpretation in terms of what the person is trying to do, rather than just a sort of factual like description of the motions that the person undertakes. And so here, when you think of like imitation, you know, if the infant were to, you know, imitate the person, in the first case with the, you know, the boxes in the hand, if the infant comes into the room and their hands are free, they would just, you know, press the, or, you know, flick the light switch with their hands, even if they had only observed the person using their head, because they understand the use of the head as a sort of, substitute for the hands when the hands are occupied. But if the infant has only observed the second version, where the person uses their head, even though their hands are free, then the infant would imitate in terms of the what they understand as this, you know, essential, you know, use of the head to flick the light switch. And it would probably try to, well, the infant probably wouldn't be tall enough to use their head. But anyway, you can sort of extrapolate from this that, like, they would imitate what they understand the person to have done, based on, you know, the sort of total grasp of the situation, even though in the two cases the you know, action of flicking the light switch was done in the same way. And I think this line where he says, where is that? You can only imitate what you can almost invent. And I'm thinking of like anyone who's taken like maybe a music lesson or something, when you're sort of like starting out and the teacher just goes, you know, do this, and then plays like some complicated, you know, arpeggio or whatever, and you're just sort of sitting there like, I have no idea how to do that. Like, you know, the fact that you as like the beginner, you know, are not even close to being able to perform this action makes it impossible for you to sort of imitate the action. Even when it's sort of displayed in front of you, you can sort of imitate the teacher when they play some simple pattern, but then when it's like something complicated, you can't even sort of like get started at trying to imitate it, because it's like so far outside. Like, you need the teacher to do something that's sort of just outside of what you're already able to do, and then you can imitate that performance, and then, you know, that sort of allows you to sort of push forward your like domain of ability in that, you know, playing that instrument. But then when you sort of watch, you know, the expert performance that is like way beyond what you're even capable of like grasping, you can't just sort of like sit down and imitate what the person is doing. You have to sort of gradually over months and years get, you know, closer and closer, by, you know, pushing a little bit beyond your existing domain of ability, at each step, rather than just sort of sitting down. Like, you would never sort of like learn to play the piano by like, I don't know, putting on a Glenn Gould recording and going, okay, I'm gonna like copy this. You would start with, you know, the, you know, very simple things that, you know, that kids start, you know, Twinkle Twinkle Little Star or whatever, and then gradually sort of, even just like listening to that recording and being like, what note follows this, like, you know, which note comes next after this note is already quite difficult to grasp. Even if you can recognize when it's the wrong note, it's hard to sort of sit down and you know, figure out what is the correct note. You don't learn these instruments or like to play an instrument just by, you know, taking like the expert, you know, virtuoso performance and then sitting down and trying to copy it.
Yeah, I wanted to say something on that real quick, just because I've in the last few days I've just seen some amazing stuff. I saw like Laurie Anderson and John Zorn last night playing together, and Steve Shelley and Thurston Moore a couple of nights ago, just doing an hour of pure feedback and noise. And you know, it's not just the complexity of the music and the memory there, but you can tell certain performers when they perform together that there's another level of communication, right? And it's not just the academic aspect of music or the pure skill of the musician. There's something else happening there, and I like how this might tie into Rouillet and this section, in that there's an access to perhaps another domain, you know, not just this material cause effect chain domain, that they're communicating within some domain of ideas or essences, you know. And if you're fortunate, you know, you can kind of key into that in the audience and kind of get along and hear what's happening. So, you know, even in a very noisy performance, Thurston Moore played with Shabaka Hutchings, who is a saxophonist, flute player, you know, jazz performer, and they did the same thing. And so he was playing the saxophone and his flute while Thurston Moore just had his guitar and amp, you know, messing around with feedback and everything. And it was amazing, you know. I mean, it was musical. I don't know. I guess I am feeling a little romantic this.
Yeah, but I think this is maybe a good example. Like even like, you know, guitar feedback, of course, like anyone can, you know, stand in front of an amp and, you know, strum a guitar and let it feedback. But most of us trying to do that would just produce annoying noise. To make that into like an actual sort of musical performance that it, you know, someone actually wants to listen to, you do have to, you know, learn, you know, where do you stand, you know, what, you know, how do you move the guitar in relation to the feedback and you know, et cetera. Like it's a skill you have to acquire. And, you know, just someone, you know, hearing this or, you know, even watching someone standing on stage doing this, you can't just sort of go, oh, I'm going to just do the exact thing that this person did. I'm going to imitate that. It's something that you have to sort of learn how to do by sort of gradually getting better at, you know, manipulating the feedback and, you know, standing in the right place and moving and so on. Yeah. So even something like, yeah. So feedback is obviously quite a different type of, I don't know, musical technique than say, you know, playing a scale on the guitar or arpeggios or whatever. But even that is still something that, yeah, you have to, you know, sort of gradually acquire skill at using to musical effect rather than just producing annoying noise.
I wanted to say about the point about resemblance. Something I was thinking about when I was reading this section is I remember reading the argument from some phenomenologist, it might have been Dan Zahavi, that he was arguing for the necessity of something like intentionality. And he pointed out that two similar looking trees, you know, in a forest, right next to each other, sort of don't stand for one another, or I think even really resemble each other, kind of in themselves. They have to be kind of grasped as resembling each other. And I was thinking maybe like a possible materialist rejoinder to Rouillet would be that, you know, these mnemic themes are just high dimensional activation vectors in like neural state space. But as with the similar trees, you know, just the fact that the same kind of pattern is firing into a similar pattern is firing into spatio-temporally distinct contexts doesn't really in itself amount to resemblance. Like, you know, the fact that my recognizing a red apple now and like 3 weeks ago in a different city, in order for those apples to really resemble each other, it seems that you need more than just the activation vector, because yeah, two similar events simply happening without any kind of grasp of the sense of the event don't really amount to what we would refer to as resemblance.
Yeah, this was a kind of recurring problem in empiricist philosophy of mind, which, you know, obviously in general is trying to sort of reduce everything going on in the human mind to, sense impressions and their, you know, relations to each other. There's one of the questions that sort of comes up, or one of the sort of like problem of resemblance is that, say you are, you are out in the park one day and you see this animal. So you have a certain, sense impression, collection of sense impressions that you sort of categorize as, here's a squirrel. And then the next day you go to the park again and you have another sort of sequence of sense impressions that you also categorize as saying here's a squirrel. So you are sort of assigning the same label to your sort of collection of sense impressions on one day and the next. But then the question is what exactly is it, how is it that you come to use the same label for these sense impressions on these two different occasions? The sort of obvious the answer that sort of comes to mind in the first instance would be just that, you see the squirrel one day and then you see a similar animal the next day and then you say, okay, this is also a squirrel. There's the resemblance or the similarity between what you saw one day and what you saw the next day is what leads you to use the same name for it. But then, similarity, of course, is not something that is itself a sense impression. You can see, a reddish brown blotch that is, moving in a certain way, but you can't see similarity in that sense, in a sort of strict empiricist sense. And all the more so when the similarity is not between, two objects that are actually present to you at a certain time, but rather, between an entity that you observed on one occasion and then another entity that you observe on a different occasion. So the two entities are not actually, present in the same spatial temporal location. You can sort of take similarity to be a kind of higher order sense impression. You can say, okay, well, there's one, sense impression or a collection of sense impressions that, makes up your experience of the squirrel on day one. And then there's this other collection of sense impressions that makes up your experience of the squirrel on day two. And, your experience of the squirrel on day two, evokes the memory of the squirrel on day one. And then your memory plus the second squirrel observation sort of evokes this second order sense impression of similarity. But then, of course, you can just sort of, extend this going further. What makes the similarity between the squirrel I saw yesterday and the squirrel I saw today, the same sort of relation as, the similarity between the tune I heard yesterday and the tune I hear today. Is this sort of meta similarity also a kind of meta sense impression or whatever? It starts to get a little bit absurd. And then there's also the sort of the question of is it something intrinsic to the sense impression that brings about the sort of second order sense impression of similarity, or is it just the fact that I sort of have this second order sense impression of similarity that makes me say that that the first sense impression and the second sense impression are similar? If it's the first, if there's a certain squirrelness about both sense impressions that produces this second order sense impression of similarity, then you're already sort of going beyond a sort of empiricist framework. You're already sort of attributing a kind of intrinsic structure to these sense impressions, and then your kind of your whole project of just sort of reconstructing the world out of these sort of sense impressions that would just be connected to each other in various ways, it has kind of broken down. But then on the other hand, if there's only the impression of similarity, then you're sort of left with that regress of okay, well, how do I know that my sort of impression of similarity on this occasion is the same kind of is doing the same thing as my sort of impression of similarity on another occasion, and then you need like a meta similarity and so on. All this is to say that, like, of course, the sort of vector space, you know, depiction of you know, what all your neurons are doing is obviously a much more sophisticated framework than, you know, the sort of empiricist idea of, you know, assembling these sense impressions in various ways. But it sort of runs into the same problem of, like, trying to sort of treat these, like, actual existing sort of arrangements as sort of making up the relationship of similarity. Sort of either leads you to go beyond, like, the similarity is either something external to these two, you know, configuration space, you know, high dimensional vectors, or it's like an even higher dimensional vector in a larger configuration space of, you know, in which the two configuration spaces are subspaces. So either way you get kind of stuck. The problem is, you know, more complicated in the case of the vector spaces, but it's the same sort of kind of problem that you run into. And this is also tied in with like in empiricist philosophy, there's a strong sort of suspicion of universals. Like, you know, Berkeley talks about how, you know, if you sort of picture a man, you have to picture the man as either tall or short, and, you know, dark hair or light hair, etc. Like, you can't just sort of picture an abstract man. Or if you imagine a triangle, it has to be, you know, either you know, equiangular or obtuse or scalene. You can't have like sort of abstract triangle that has no particular combination of angles. When you sort of picture a triangle for yourself, and so he takes this as a kind of like refutation of the idea that you can have a concept of a triangle as such, as like a, you know, a triangle that would not sort of specify that, you know, what angles make up that triangle. And I think, you know, from a more sort of contemporary perspective, we could say this is kind of like a conflation of like an image that you're imagining of a triangle on the one hand, which, you know, maybe you do have to sort of specify what angles the triangles in your, you know, imagination have, and then the concept of a triangle, which is not itself an image. So Berkeley took this to be a sort of, you know, refutation of the, you know, the idea that you could have a, you know, an abstract concept of man or an abstract concept of triangle. He says these are just names that you sort of apply to, you know, certain impressions that you have. You know, you have a bunch of impressions and you apply the word man to these impressions. But then, of course, the question is, you know, what is it about these impressions that makes you apply the word man to them, and all these other impressions you use dog or triangle or whatever and not man? And then if you say it's because these are, you know, similar impressions, that, you know, the you know, these impressions are similar and therefore I'm applying the word man to these ones, and then these other ones are different and therefore I'm applying, you know, this, you know, the word dog or triangle, then you're kind of back to a sort of recognition that there's something universal about this collection of impressions. There's some property that these impressions share that makes them, you know, impressions to which you can apply the word man. Like, this is the kind of thing that Hegel would have loved. There's something about these impressions that makes you rightly apply the word man to these impressions and not to these other ones. And then your whole argument for, you know, the non-existence of universals kind of collapses. But then if you just say, oh, it's just, you know, I happen to have this sort of feeling of similarity or this impression of similarity, then there's no sort of reason to say that, you know, applying the label man to these impressions is, you know, correct or incorrect. It's just, you know, I happen to feel this urge to use the label man when I see this, when I have this impression, and then I don't have that urge when I have this other impression. But if someone else does have the urge to, you know, call a triangle a man, then I can't say, oh, that was, you know, the incorrect or, you know, this is the wrong category to apply to this geometrical figure. It's just, you know, there's one impression that happens in me, and there's a different impression that happens in another person, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, a lot of that reminds me of the of Wittgenstein's family resemblance arguments, and very similar considerations about the ability to kind of subsume a kind under an abstract universal, so to speak. But the kind of undeniability of the fact that, you know, even if it's just a family resemblance, and we can't really, in a finally satisfying way, articulate a rule that, you know, makes all games games, still there is something that makes them something that kind of makes them games. It's not wrong to call a board game and a soccer match a game, even if we can't always finally articulate why they belong in the same category.
Yeah, I mean, the game example is a pretty complicated one, because it what exactly counts as a game? Of course, it involves all kind, like, you basically would have to have a whole sort of theory of human society and human behavior as such, like, in, you know, as a whole, to be able to say, like, what is it for something to be a game? Even at like a much more sort of basic level, like, you know, of course, we talked about this before, that like the sort of early attempts at developing like AI technology were often oriented towards like a rules-based system. Like, you would just sort of input a bunch of rules into this computer, and the computer would apply these rules to whatever input you give it, and, you know, make a decision or you know, give an output. That, so you could, like, you know, give a bunch of rules for like what is it that makes up the pattern of a letter A, for example, and then you give it a bunch of inputs, and it would, you know, tell you, is this a letter, like, is this image that you've put into this computer an image that shows the letter A or not? And, you know, this obviously, like, recognizing the letter A is a pretty simple task for anyone who, you know, knows the Latin alphabet. Giving a set of rules that can, you know, correctly classify images as either, you know, containing the letter A or not containing the letter A is extremely complicated. When you think of, like, the image could have various colors, you know, you could have a black letter A on a white background, or a white letter A on a black background. So you'd have to have a rule that sort of like is abstract enough to capture both of these cases. And then you can have, you know, a capital A or a lowercase A. You can have, you know, handwritten or typed. You can have various fonts. The letter can be at different orientations on the page. It can be, you know, horizontal or vertical, etc. When you think of like all these different combinations, like even just the very simple task of, you know, recognizing is this a letter A or not turns out to be extremely complicated to sort of set out in explicit rules. And I think pretty much all the sort of actual applications of, you know, recognizing letters have instead relied on some sort of learning algorithm, where you essentially just feed into the computer a bunch of labeled examples. So you have a bunch of images that someone has, you know, sort of assigned a label to say this image contains a letter A, this one is a letter X, etc. There's an algorithm that sort of brings about the result that using, you know, weights of different nodes, etc. It brings about the result that the computer is capable of outputting the correct response to the input, with enough, you know, sufficient accuracy for whatever application it is. So, you know, if it's, say, like categorizing mail, you know, that the address on, or the postal code or zip code or whatever on a piece of mail, and assigning it to the right, you know, box in the mail room, it might be 99% accuracy might be enough. And you can say, okay, we've fed it with enough examples that now this computer system is capable of recognizing the letters correctly 99% of the time, and therefore that's good enough for us. And here, like, you as the programmer or you as the designer of the system have not sort of explained or set out any rules to tell the system, here's how you recognize a letter A. You've just sort of given it a bunch of examples and let it sort of produce its own set of weights that has the result that it can correctly recognize the letter A most of the time, or, you know, enough of the time for your purposes. And if you sort of examine this system to try to figure out, you know, what is it learned, like how is it recognizing the letter A, all you have is just a bunch of numerical weights of nodes it's actually quite difficult to figure out, like, what is it the computer, you know, responding to in the visual inputs it's receiving, you know, the images that you're feeding in. Like, what is it about these images that it has learned? What pattern has it extracted to sort of be able to recognize the letter A? Like, there's a whole sort of subdiscipline of explainable AI, which is trying to ensure that you can figure out what the system is sort of learning when you feed it this information.
Yeah, I as we've been going through this book, I've tried to stay with where we are in the reading, but I may have to read through the rest of the book, because I really want to see where he's taking this. But this conversation, I mean, this is the question, right? This is the question that that a lot of philosophy, science, it's all dealing with these things. And the way I'm understanding Rouillet is he's sort of setting up these different levels or a hierarchy, within which you could potentially answer these questions, you know, like the sort of material domain, the I conscious domain, and then the deeper domain, the consciousness of the embryo, the embryonic or consciousness or whatever. And I think what he's been doing is showing that a lot of the arguments or how people are trying to solve or answer this question, they're trapped within one of these different explanatory domains, and therefore can never really answer the question because the real answer lies a little bit deeper, you know, another level, you know, approaching this absolute domain or whatever it is he's setting up there. But this domain where you would find all of that. So that's why all of our, you know, a materialist explanation is never going to succeed, because it's trapped, you know, several steps below where the real explanation lies.
Yeah. So what I wanted to get at with the sort of explanation, a little bit of the sort of machine learning, you know, pattern recognition stuff, is that it's extremely difficult for us to, you know, set out explicit rules for, you know, how do you recognize a letter A. But obviously the fact that a human is capable of learning this, that you can, you know, develop this machine learning algorithm that is capable of learning this, demonstrates that there is some pattern, there is something about, you know, this collection of images or this collection of, you know, samples of writing that makes it the case that, you know, one collection contains the letter A and this other collection does not. There's some sort of structure that is, you know, detectable or learnable, even if it's very hard for us to express. And even like even simpler than that, you can think of like color perception. Like we've talked about this, I think, during the Merleau-Ponty reading, that like color perception is actually much more complicated than it, you know, maybe seems. That like we sort of feel as if we just sort of, you know, things have colors and we just see those colors and that's all there is to it. It's actually, you know, we have, a color constancy in our sort of perception of colors, that like a white sheet of paper still looks white, whether you're seeing it under, you know, sunlight or under candlelight or electric light, etc. But if you just sort of look at the wavelengths of light that are striking your retina in these different situations, you can have totally different light patterns that are striking the retina that sort of get interpreted as the same color. So even just getting a machine system, like a camera of some kind, you know, with a computer attached to it, to sort of recognize, you know, what color a person would sort of assign to this object, that is already something that would require probably a sort of machine learning type of system, as opposed to like, I don't know how you would sort of come up with a set of rules to say like, if the wavelength of light is such and such, then this object is white. So I think you would probably need to set up a machine learning system that would essentially be sort of reproducing the human color constancy ability to be able to sort of correctly predict, a human would assign this object the color white, would say this object is white or this object is green or whatever. So what this sort of demonstrates is that there is this sort of level of essences or universals or whatever that is being grasp that is not sort of identical to just the level of the physical wavelengths of light in the color example, or in the case of the letters, there's no sort of like collection of just purely geometric rules to say, you know, if there's a curve, you know, of such and such properties, you know, and a straight line that's, you know, this ratio to the curve, etc., therefore you have a letter A or something like that. Like there would be no sort of like straightforward way of coming up with that collection of geometric properties of you know, dark lines on a page or whatever, that would sort of correctly classify the letters. But there's a kind of like essence of the letter A, which is maybe more abstract than that sort of physical set of arrangements of ink on paper that you're capable of grasping, you know, when you learn how to recognize the letter A in all the different sort of circumstances in which it can appear.
Yeah, the point about the machine learning, the contrast with machine learning is interesting in part because it's sort of like, you know, if you just had two neural networks that had been trained to recognize colors or to, you know, output the correct response in response to visual stimuli as to their colors, it would sort of be like, just the neural pattern in itself, I guess. It seems to me that for Rouillet, if you could have a neural network like this kind of running in a unsupervised, in like a, I don't know, a forest somewhere, there wouldn't be, even though it would correctly be outputting, you know, from the perspective of, you know, a observing engineer or something, correctly be outputting like green or blue, depending on what passes in front of it, it still wouldn't, or I guess I should say, I'm not sure that it would be, you know, the grasp of a mnemic theme until, you know, there's a kind of enveloping consciousness that can observe the output and say that it's, you know, a correct correlation or, you know, the right answer. It's sort of just, yeah, it is just the third person perspective on the neural pattern rather than self-surveying machinic setup.
Yeah. So if you picture, yeah, you have like, I don't know, you set up a camera and a laptop in the middle of a forest somewhere that has this, you know, color classifying algorithm running on it. And then you go off, and then maybe everyone who has, you know, any knowledge of this experiment, you know, mysteriously dies, and this laptop is just running. I don't know. It has like a generator or something. I don't know. Or a mega battery. It's just running in the forest for years and just, you know, keeps classifying, you know, outputting, you know, this is green or this is not green, etc. Does this, you know, system, you know, is there some sort of like cognition going on in the system? And then I think most of us would say no. It's all it's doing, like, all there is going on here is that, you know, there are certain, you know, memory registers on the, or even like more sort of fine grain, there's like certain regions of the hard drive on this computer are magnetized and others are not. And then there's, you know, electrical current passing in various ways through the circuits in this computer. And if no one is, you know, if the computer is just running and, you know, outputting, you know, a one whenever it recognizes, whenever it's, you know, determined through this algorithm that there's a green thing in front of its camera, you know, it's just going to keep, you know, outputting one or zero, or and there's no, there's not, it's not doing anything with this output. The output is completely meaningless for the system. Whereas, you know, if your sort of green detection system is, I don't know, feeding into some other system, or there's someone watching the feed and saying, oh, there's a green item here, let's go check it out, for whatever reason. Anyway, if that output of, you know, green or not green is, you know, doing something, it has some sort of meaning to someone, then it's quite a different situation than, you know, the laptop in a forest on its own detecting green things, you know, into eternity, with no one, you know, doing anything with that detection. So yeah, what was in one case just a, you know, a certain you know, pattern of, you know, currents of electricity in a circuit, then can also can sort of secondarily become, you know, part of a broader system that includes both the laptop and the person that sort of uses that detection of green things to, you know, achieve a certain goal or perform a certain task or whatever it is. But yeah, on its own, it's just, you know, electricity flowing through a circuit in a certain way and not another way.
Yeah. Again, apologies in advance. I'm just, my mind is just sort of off in this other place. But yeah, I mean, essentially what I'm hearing here is that at some level, machine learning, even what we do, it's always just, you're just correlating two different patterns. You know, this is always the issue with symbolic representation, is that you're restricting the space somewhat of what that symbol is supposed to represent. You know, and at every level, this is going to happen. You know, with machine learning, at best, all it's ever really doing is, you know, maybe with a very, very high degree of accuracy, it's making its best guess at distinctions between two different symbolic representations that we have assigned. You know, green is assigned to this. You know, it's just the subject object distinction in that particular whatever that particular problem at that point is. You know, but I mean, even there, I don't know if you've ever, like, if you sit down and just like say stare at a color like a green or a red, you know, sort of as a meditative practice, and you may start to experience even there that that breakdown of the distinction between yourself as the subject and that color as the object, you know, and go through those different levels where first there's just, this is green, this is the color green, and then you might start to get sort of the emotional connection that you have to that color and certain other things. So yeah, I don't know. I just ultimately, yeah, there is some point where this all starts to break down.
Yeah, just on the sort of machine learning side. So the type of machine learning algorithm that I was sort of talking about would be like a supervised learning process where you feed in labeled examples. So you know, here's an image. This image contains the letter A. Here's another image. This image contains the letter W, etc. You feed in, you know, many thousands of examples that have, you know, the label of what letter is present in the image, and you know, after sort of processing through all these examples, the system is capable of recognizing the letters, you know, to a desired degree of accuracy. That's one sort of type of machine learning algorithm that you can run. But you could also do a clustering algorithm. You can say, like, so you just start out from a certain, you give it a number of clusters. You say, I want 10 clusters or say 26 clusters. And then you tell it, and then you just give it a bunch of examples, and it sort of classifies those examples by, you know, similarity in some sense. It says, you know, these ones are closer to each other in whatever sense. And it just, you know, clusters those examples it's received into, say, 10 clusters or 26 clusters or whatever. And those may or may not correspond to the categories that a person would identify. That, you know, maybe if you give it a bunch of, you know, thousands of images of letters, and you say, you know, come up with 26 clusters of these images, you know, maybe it would, like, you know, probably the letter A would be in a different category than the letter X. You know, most of the A examples would be in a different category than the letter X examples, but maybe the some of the letter A examples and some of the letter O examples might be in the same category, for example, or, you know, it the categories it comes up with might not sort of map onto the categories that humans who know the Latin alphabet would assign to the letters. And of course, when you're dealing with like handwriting samples of not just a single letter, but like a word, there's also, you know, ambiguous, you know, is this an N and an I, or is it an M, et cetera? So the sort of labeled examples where you start with like an existing label and you know, a bunch of examples of inputs that are given that label, that's one type of machine learning process, but there's also processes where you just give it a bunch of inputs and say, you know, find 10 clusters or 26 clusters or whatever. And so you don't give it the labels in advance. And the output may or may not make any sense for a person. Like, you know, sometimes I know the companies use sort of like market decomposition. Like you have like, you know, 10 million customers, and you sort of break down your customers into 100 categories of, you know, type of customer. But you don't sort of tell it in advance, you know, here's what is a type, like, here are the 100 categories that we want you to use, you know, you being the machine learning system. You just say, you know, find, you know, classify these 10 million customers into 100 categories. And some of those categories might make some sort of sense to a person. Like, you might find that, you know, all the, you know, women age 25 to 35 who live in the suburbs are sort of assigned to one category. That you can say, okay, I understand what this category is. But it could also just be like there's some sort of property that this system is sort of identifying about these customers, and a person looking at them would not really, you know, understand what it is that, you know, the various customers that fall under this category have in common. There's no sort of obvious resemblance from a human perspective, but the machine learning system has, you know, identified some pattern in the information that the company has about these customers that, you know, makes them be grouped together. So there's no sort of necessity of using a label, or even once the categorization is done, there's no necessity that categorization even sort of makes sense to a person looking at it. In some cases, it's quite difficult to figure out, like, what exactly, like, why does the system categorize these customers as, you know, belonging to the same category, when, you know, a person looking at it doesn't see any resemblance or any, you know, principle that would sort of make this category make sense. I'm just realizing we're a little bit over time here, so I think we're gonna have to wrap up here. We went a little bit slower today, but that's fine. That's, you know, part of the beauty of this type of group, that we can go at our own pace. We will pick up from page 130 next time. Thanks everyone for coming out. Hope to see you next week.